And we're going to start with appointment and disclosures and standards, because this is obviously all of us aspire to get appointed to these cases. And people come up sometimes and ask me, well, should I cozy up to the International Chamber of Commerce, the ICC, or the LCIA, which is the London Court of International Arbitration, or one of those centers? And the answer is there really isn't much need to do that in order to start getting appointed. All of these organizations and the rules of these provider organizations have party-appointed systems. So if there are three arbitrators, if it's a single arbitrator, the institution will appoint. But if it's any sizable case, it will invariably, not always, but most often, be a three-arbitrator tribunal. And in that case, for example, the ICC specifies, and I should... I will give you the citations. Yes, ICC is Article 12.4. You'll find, and the ICC rules, by the way, for those with binders, the ICC rules are tab 8. And if you, I have it as page 21 of those rules. 12.4, in the event there are three arbitrators, the party who's the claimant appoints one in the statement of claim, which is also the request for arbitration, and the respondent in the answer appoints its party-appointed arbitrators, and the two so appointed pick the chair. If they can't pick the chair, then can't come to an agreement, then the ICC will appoint through a kind of national system whereby they'll go to the committee or the national committee, probably in the place that's designated in the arbitration, and that national committee will select. However, here in the United States, which is, I think, the second or third largest venue or most arbitrations for the ICC, I think they made upwards of 10, maybe, appointments. That's all in the entire year, last year. So the odds that you'll get appointed by the ICC are slim to none, but it doesn't matter that much because they had a lot of arbitrations. So the other arbitrators were selected by the parties, by counsel for the parties, and the two so selected chose the third. Now that system is the same system as in the JAMS International Arbitration Rules, which you will find in tab 7. And Article 8.4 at page 12 of those rules has the same party-appointed system. You will also find the party-appointed system generally in all the European systems. And if there are no, we'll get to if the parties don't designate. But you get your work from the lawyers who do the appointing. So what you should do if you want an appointment is you should make it known, especially to the international commercial lawyers, that you know that you're in the business, that you're anxious to get an appointment, and that you would appreciate it. They're the ones who will, in fact, appoint you. With respect to the selection of the third, there's a lot of back and forth often about that. You are entitled to, and indeed expected to, consult with a party who appointed you over the selection of the chair. However, there are ethics rules that govern what you can say and who you can, what the party who is appointing you can ask you when you are selected. A question that often arises is, is it ethical for you to receive a phone call, let's say, from a lawyer who is interested in appointing you? The answer is yes. There's no law against getting on the phone. However, there are restrictions about what can be asked. And with respect to those restrictions, the international rules are pretty well the same as the domestic code of ethics for arbitrators. You'll find that in tab 16 That's the AAA, ABA Code of Ethics. JAMS also has a Code of Ethics. Basically, you could be asked about what your experience is, how much you charge, although we'll get to that with respect to some of these provider organizations do not do it by an hourly fee basis. But you can be asked that. You can be asked whether you have the time to devote. You can be asked about your experience generally. But you should not be allowed to be drawn into discussions about the merits, because there are disclosure obligations if, in fact, you have those conversations. With respect to the selection of a chair, the side who appoints you undoubtedly expects you to, and there's nothing wrong with consulting with that party with respect to who the chair ought to be. And it's we don't have the time to go into all the methods of choosing a chair, but there are a lot of ways to do it. Sometimes people exchange names, a list of five, and then someone may pick someone off the other one's list, or you may get a match. Other times you agree with your counterpart, who is the other party appointed arbitrator, what qualities you want in the chair, and then it'll be easier to make a list. And sometimes the parties will take over and they'll tell you who the chair is going to be. I have one case in which the party-appointed arbitrators are given three names and said, pick a chair from any one of those three, all of whom are acceptable. There's no set way to appoint a chair. Let's put it that way. And I should say this just generally, and is that I'm here, Pat is here. There are people on the West Coast, Rich Chernick mainly, who are available to discuss these things with you if you get into a situation and you want to talk about it. So feel free to call us, to ask questions about the process if you get into that situation. I would not discourage it. I found that parties who appoint me are very anxious to have a say. And in fact, I've been asked the question on the initial call is it your habit or do you feel free to consult us with respect to the identity of the chair? So I think it's helpful for appointments and to understand the party who appointed you won't be surprised or simply get a name from the other two party-appointed arbitrators. They will, in fact, be able to consult. Once in a while, they've agreed that only the two party-appointed arbitrators are to select, and they are not to be consulted. I find that to be very rare in my own experience. All right, with respect to the standards, there are no such things as predisposed or partial arbitrators in international arbitration. No such thing. All right. Here in the U.S., the ethical rules provide for a default situation of neutrality for party-appointed arbitrators, and you can read that in this ABA-AAA Code of Ethics, tab 16. But it allows the parties to either put in their arbitration agreement or subsequently agree that the party-appointed arbitrators are to be, quote, predisposed, unquote. That was the old default rule in most U.S. jurisdictions prior to, I think, 2002, when these ethics rules came into play. In the international arena, you will find uniformly the rule, and it'll be recited in the provider rules, that all arbitrators are to be impartial and independent. Now, JAMS has a form, which you've probably seen for arbitrations, a questionnaire which you fill out, which helps you to answer questions and to think about whether or not you are, in fact, within the definition of impartiality and independence. The international organizations really don't have those forms, and it's been a very loose standard. Recently, the ICC has amended, or at least has given you letters or some guidance as to what you should do. But if you look at the JAMS form, you will find, I think, sufficient guidance. One of the things that you have to disclose, at least by the ICC, and which you should disclose anyway, is if the law firm who appointed you has appointed you before, even if the lawyers are different and the type of case is different. And the general rule is within the past 5 years. That's not recited specifically in a lot of these rules, but I think it's becoming a convention or a protocol that you don't have to go way back to the beginning of time. But certainly in the past 5 years, you should disclose everything that you should disclose to give parties confidence that you are impartial and you are independent. If you want some guidance as to what ought to be disclosed, at least from the international community, you have at tab 14, and I'll just mention it briefly, but at tab 14, the International Bar Association, the IBA, has promulgated these guidelines, and this one is in very common use. It's called the IBA Guidelines on Conflicts of Interest in International Arbitration. And you have part one is standards on page four, standards regarding impartiality, independence, and disclosure. And what this does is it gives you a regime of colors, red, orange, and green, right?
Yes.
Maybe I should go the other way, green, orange, and red. Green are things you don't have to disclose. Orange are things you should disclose, but they can't be waived. And red are things that you must disclose, along with the orange, except some of them are non-waivable, and one or two of the reds are, in fact, waivable. You can read that. They're commonsensical, but some of them are like, for example, if you're a member of the same organization, or if you're on a board with someone else, they're very good guidance. Now, the ICC makes it clear, and the other organizations fairly clear, that just because you fulfill the qualifications or in the IBA guidelines, or you follow the guidelines on conflicts of interest, doesn't mean automatically you're home free with respect to the provider organization's own standards. But if you look at these guidelines, they're very helpful to tell you what at least the general international community believes should be disclosed. The other thing that I want to get into before we move, I guess, to the next topic will be how you get compensated in these cases.